The mules are in the corral. Welcome to Mule Talk, and I'm Cindy K. Roberts, your host.
And our author, TV personality, and world-renowned mule trainer, Meredith Hodges of the Lucky Three Ranch. We are back on, and I want to say to you, Meredith, that I am grateful, and I thank my lucky stars that we get to bring good content to our listeners. So this podcast, it means a lot to me to have you here.
It means a lot to me, too, because that's my focus, too, Cindy, is to give people good factual information that will benefit them and their animals.
This is all important. So, and today we're going to do Keys to Successful Training, Part 1, which is your working environment. And I really like this topic.
I do, too, because it really makes a big difference as to how consistent you are and whether or not your animal feels comfortable in the training environment. And that can only happen if you are repetitive and have a designated workstation for your animal to be in. And sometimes that's going to change a little bit because in the beginning, if you're working with a foal or a new animal, even just leading to a workstation can be a real challenge. They have to have enough time to get comfortable with you. That may be that you have to stay in a smaller pen for a while where you have put the foal and the mare, or where you have put your newly acquired animal that isn't used to you, no matter what age they are.
Right.
So that's where you need to begin. For this reason, you know, you will go to this smaller area. This will be preparation for his lessons, and you'll do easy lessons that you can do in a smaller area without all the details that you will do later in the larger area at the workstation. When you have a workstation, generally speaking, most people don't have a confined area like I do, but that is ideal to have a confined area indoors where you can have a hitch rail, have your tack and equipment inside where it's going to stay clean and everything, and easily accessible. I started with an old Quonset building, and a lot of these farms have old buildings that you can adapt to this kind of a workstation situation. You don't even really have to build a wall. If there's four walls around it, all you have to do is put your tack and equipment at one end of it and sink a hitch rail in the other end where you can tie your animal, and then you can be inside. So no matter what the weather is, you'll be able to protect yourself and your animal from the weather conditions and do simple exercises, which in a lot of cases is just getting them used to the brushes, the grooming equipment, the tack and equipment. And you can do that indoors in a smaller area. But first, like I was saying, you've got to get the animal used to you and used to following you on the lead rope. And that's a very simple thing. We're not even going to talk about good posture when you're leading your animal from one place to another, like you would have to do once they're used to being led by you. Then you can lead them from their confined area to a workstation.
Okay.
So you want to begin your leading training in the smaller area. And that begins with feeding them and just being around. When this pen is your workstation, it's also going to be the area where you feed them. So you can go ahead and feed them, and if it's a foal, you teach them how to come to you by carrying oats in your fanny pack. And granted, if he's really young, he's not going to want the oats, but he will be curious about you. And if mom is eating in a designated area, the best place for you would be standing at her shoulder. And then when the foal comes up, then you can go ahead and start to touch him. And mom won't get anxious about that because you're standing right next to her. Right. Now, if you go stand somewhere else in that pen and want the foal to come to you, then mom's going to get anxious about it when the foal goes to you and isn't close by her. So you really, really need those kinds of things taken into consideration. If you have an animal that is new, the same rules apply, minus the mare, minus the second animal. You want to keep them by themselves in a pen that's next to other animals so that they don't feel anxious and isolated. And you feed them in the same place all the time, which should be feeding near the fence that separates them from the other animals, so they don't have to go away from the other animals to eat, because then they'll become anxious and they won't feel comfortable while they're eating. And if you stand in the area where they're being fed to get them used to you, an older animal will be happy to get the oats that you have to offer out of the fanny pack that you're carrying. But make sure when you're doing that you are by the fence, and not the one that separates them, but maybe one that is the adjacent fence that comes to a corner. So you'd be feeding them sort of in the corner next to the fence that separates the animals. But if they get a little radical or something with you and don't like you near their feet or whatever, even though you're giving them oats, that you have another fence to jump, to climb up out of that pen really fast, or a gate to go through for an escape, a quick escape. Because with an animal you don't know, you don't know how they're going to behave. The other thing is if you have a mare or a jennet with a new foal, they may take exception to you being in the pen with them.
Right. Wow.
So you need a really easy way to exit quickly. So just thinking about how you're feeding, where you're feeding, and how you're interacting with the animals and things that might happen, you will be able to think about what way might be the safest approach. Now, granted, with a new animal, once they figure out that you got a fanny pack full of oats there, and you're there in the morning because you only feed the oats mix at night, then they will be happier accepting your gift, a reward for being nice, of a handful of oats to eat with their hay. So it would be safe for you to stand there with a little bit more distance than you would between a mare and a foal, and you would stand more towards their head and close to the escape fence if need be, so you can see what their head's going to do right away, if they're going to reach up and try to bite you, or if they're going to try to strike at you with the front foot, or even whirl around and try to kick you. You've got a few seconds to climb that fence. Just make that fence close enough so you can do that. But generally speaking, once they figure out that you have the oats, then they're going to get more friendly and they're more apt to approach you. Now, a lot of people think that to get them used to you, starting in a small pen is a good idea, okay? But people take a chair into the pen and they sit in the middle of the pen in a chair and hope this animal is going to be curious about them, curious enough about them, so that they will come up to you eventually. Well, you could be sitting there for months. Because there's no incentive for them to come up to the damn chair. And some people sit on the ground, which only puts you at risk if they decide that you're a predator and they need to be rid of you in that pen because it's just utterly uncomfortable. Then they will attack you. But if you use your senses, your common sense, and realize that food is a really good motivation for them to come to you and not wait and just have no food in the pen for them to come to, except what you're offering, they may take exception to that too and say, oh, this feels like a trap to me. Which they probably will. They have second senses that we don't have. Well, we have them, but we don't use them. That it looks like a trap, feels like a trap, then it probably is a trap. So that's not going to be in there without hay on the ground in front of you. It's a trap. And they'll know it. But if you go there and stand next to the hay and let them get to the hay first and then start walking to find your position near the escape fence and have the hay next to the separation fence, then you will be able to determine how close you can get before they back off that hay pile. And when they start to back off, they're telling you, that's how much space I'm giving you. Stay there.
Okay,
and take the hint and stay there. And then don't try to approach them right away. Just kind of start fiddling with the fanny pack. Undo the zipper. Play with the oats. And while they're eating their hay, they're going to be eyeballing you. And when you see them looking at you, and this is going to teach you how to read their body language and how they can read yours. And this is your first communication. Then you see that eyeball looking at you while you're playing with the oats, and you go, oh, would you like some of these? And at first, you don't extend your arm. You just take your hand out of the fanny pack, and it's got oats in it. And then you will be able to see whether there is more interest than just looking at you, because they're going to stop chewing the hay and they're going to look at you like, oh, maybe that looks better. That is your cue to extend your hand a little further. And if they show more interest, then that's an invitation for you to take a step forward towards them. If they back off a little bit from the hay pile, then that is their indication that maybe you need to take that hand back a little bit. And now we're talking details and communication. Right. And you just play with that. And when they finally allow you to step up to the hay pile and they have their head up and their nose to your hand, let them have the oats. And then while they're chewing it, put your hand back into the fanny pack. Take one step backwards a little bit to indicate to them that you're not trying to trap them. Pull out another handful, and when they're done chewing, if they extend their nose to you, then you take that step forward again, and you give them the oats. This is the beginning of the small pen training. This is what the kind of action that you should be doing with them, and you should not hurry anything like that. And don't even think about introducing the halter. If you're in a pen with a shed, you're going to have to take your time with them until they accept you being there, accept the oats. Don't mind you taking your hands and moving it over their forehead and their nose and then down their neck and doing that kind of imprinting training before you even think about introducing a halter. And it could take months. Have you got months of patience? Because you should. And if you don't, you're going to learn it, because otherwise you're going to end up getting into a chase game that you're going to be playing for the rest of whatever.
Yep.
Who's training who here? Are we really training each other, or are we developing a mutual relationship of satisfaction with each other? That's what you should think about all this training is. So once you get that accomplished in that small pen, then you can start thinking about establishing your actual workstation. Because once you get them to where they'll allow you to put the halter on, then you can start leading them around. And if they balk on you, then you just reach in the fanny pack and you go, I thought you wanted this. And you just stop. And then they stop. And they don't run off. You've just commanded their curiosity, that's all.
Yep.
The mules are very, very curious. They'll go, why is she acting like that? The last time she acted like that, I got to eat oats. Well, I think I'll pay attention, you know? And so when they do pay attention, learn to reward the attention. Don't think you're just, that's not a treat. That is rewarding the attention. Now, a treat is when you don't command any kind of response from them. Then you feed them anyway. Coaxing is very close to bribing, but it's not the same thing. Bribing means you feed them along, and then when they pull against you and run away, then you start feeding them along again.
Right.
Coaxing is different. Coaxing is, now I've commanded the attention, now I've rewarded the attention, now I'm going to take a step away, and I'm going to encourage them to come to me. And you have to step away a little bit so that you can reward a step that they take towards you. And if you don't give them any room to take that step, then you're going to end up bribing. You're going to step into bribing, if you know what I mean. So you want to get far enough away, one or two steps, and then ask them to come to you again. And if they start to pull away from you again or start to get the rope tense, then you just take your attention away from them and you fiddle with a fanny pack again, which will command their attention again. But you don't take a step towards them and you don't give them another reward because you've already given them one for attention. And you go, oh, well, I already showed you what this is. So if you want some more, you got to come over here. And they go, oh, I do? And you go, yes, you do. Yes, you do. I'm not going to go that backwards. You got to come forward. And when you do, I'll give this to you. So if they take one step towards you, then you go, see, I'm not a liar. I do what I say. I give you what I promise. And you go ahead and give them that handful, and you stand there and wait. And that's what's called coaxing. And then when they're through chewing that, then you just take two steps away. And you go, are you coming this way? You try to lead them. If they lead, fine, take as many steps as they'll go. As soon as you feel that tension, stop. Go ahead, look at them and go, don't you want to come over here? Do you remember this? And you reach in your fanny pack and you show it to them. And then you tell them again, no, I'm not coming over there to give it to you. You have to come over here. And then you just hold the tension on the rope and ask them to come to you. Again, the same procedure. Now, one of the posts I did on Facebook here recently was about the quick twist. And people were really concerned about the quick twist because they said certain ropes won't slide through the halter very easily. It might cut off their airflow. Now, you need to know what the quick twist is. You just take your lead rope and feed it through, forward, through the noseband, over the nose, and then you're still hanging on to the end, but if they pull on it, it tightens down on their nose, and it limits the air going through their nostrils.
Right.
It's not meant to be pulled on. This is why I say it's really important to teach yourself that when there's tension on the lead rope, stop. Stop moving. And if you've got one that's really difficult, which you really might have on a new mule, you might, after you get them used to the halter, if they just won't come with you, just take that half hitch right through the noseband and over their nose. But do the exercise the same way. When you feel tension on it, stop. Because the lead rope has got to be able to be released in the quick twist. And when they take that step forward, it will. If you use a soft cotton lead rope and a woven nylon halter that has a nice nose band that doesn't tighten up like a rope halter will.
Right.
Can't do this with a rope halter. You have to have something that has enough shape and form to it that stays in its shape and form pretty much all the time, no matter what you do with it. And these nylon woven halters, like I said, the nose band will be not snug up against their nose. It will fit. It will lay on their nose around the noseband when it fits them, and it will lay around the throat latch. And so anything that you do, the halter fits the head. And there should be enough of a gap on that noseband for that cotton lead rope to just slide through really easy when they're giving you the slack and coming forward. When they step back on it, it gets tight. But you only hold the tight, and they've got the control over whether it's loose or tight, not you. You stand still like a post. You do not move.
Right.
You don't give them slack, because if you give them slack, then you're going to have to pull it tight again, and then they're going to be irritated.
Right.
Because it's unpredictable. And anything unpredictable or abrupt is going to cause anxiety and resistance. So you just act like a non-threatening post. This is what I'm going to do when you're going to pull back. And then reach in the fanny pack with your free hand and this is what I'm going to do when you don't pull back. Very clear communication. This is all body language. This is learning to speak body language between the two of you. And when you're in the small pen too, one of the things that will help with this, if they don't come with you and they pull hard against the lead rope no matter what you do, then you just make sure that you got a nice stout post. You don't use the quick twist when you do this. Do not do that. It's only when the lead rope's in your hands should you use the quick twist. But if they're pulling on you and they won't come with you, just pick the nearest post and tie them up. And then walk away from them. And then they'll go, where are you going? And you'll go, I don't know. You're not being very pleasant to be around right now, so right. I think I'll leave. Right. You know, you wanted to leave, but I'm the one that's going to leave here. So then you just walk away for a few minutes, stand there and look at them and play with the oats and stuff. When you've got their attention again, then walk back over there and start. There should be about 3 feet slack in the lead rope where you tie them. So you just reach over and you grab the lead rope and you say, come here, come to me. And you ask for a step towards you. And if they give you a step towards you, then they get the oats. If they don't, just drop the lead rope. And I said, and just go, I told you that you got to come to me, and you can't act like I'm the devil. So I'm leaving. If you think that much of me, I'm leaving. I won't bother you then, because you obviously don't want to be bothered. So then walk away. Go play with the oats again. Oh, this is fun. Wouldn't you rather have these oats than pulling against me? And then you walk back to them. This verbal communication that you're giving in baby language has a great effect on them, too. They really appreciate that language doesn't sound so threatening to them. Right. So then you walk back over and you say, did I hear you say that you wanted some of this? And you say, well, then come here then. And you give a couple tugs on the rope again. If they take the step forward, then you give them the oats. If they still take a step back, then this is the second try. Then you go, well, I can see that you're very adamant about not interacting with me, so I will give you some time to think about it. And you walk away and you leave the pen. Mm. And you go away for like 10 minutes, maybe 15 even. And depends on how adamant they are. If they seem to be kind of halfway one way or the other, then 10 minutes. If they're really adamant about it, okay, then you can have your 15 minutes. And you leave. And then you come back and you go, did you miss me? And you go in and you show them the oats again, and you go inside the pen and see if you got their attention. And then if you do, then you walk over there and you give a little tug on the rope. 9 times out of 10, they'll give you that step then, and you can feed them the oats. And if they do, then you go, oh, good, that's good. And if you back away, then you can untie the rope. And when you untie the rope, then you give a little tug and you back away a little bit. And if they come with you, then you give them some more oats. And you just play that game that we described earlier about coaxing and rewarding and coaxing and rewarding, but avoiding treat and bribing. That's the difference between those terms.
Yeah.
So when you read about that in things that I outline here in my training program, a lot of people want to know, what's the difference? Well, that's the difference. This beginning training you'll be able to find in DVD number 1 and DVD number 8 of my series, this leading training, that will, I cover it in open areas through the hourglass pattern, but these are the same principles that you will use in the smaller pen. And when your animal starts following you easily, anywhere you want to go, and letting you put the halter on, taking the halter off without running off from you, then it's time to start taking them to your workstation. And like I said, you can use any number of places. I discourage making the workstation a place that's out in the open.
Right, right.
Because that just invites them to bolt and run.
Mm-hmm.
And you want them to look around themselves and see, that this is not about bolting and running. This is about, we're going to do some exercises here. They're called grooming and getting used to tack and everything. And all this stuff, you have practiced in the smaller pen. So essentially, going into an enclosed workstation is similar to loading into a trailer. It's in a confined space, and they need to trust you before they'll go in there. But it's going to be really convenient for you to be able to continue your training, doing the grooming, the tack imprinting, and all of that. I call it imprinting because that's really what it is. And so you've got this designated area and this enclosed area, and your tack is at the back of the room. They can either see it, or you've got a wall between it with a door that they can see it. When you first take them in there, walk them around the room and let them see everything. Show them that they don't have any need to be afraid of it. Now, the kind of training you can do in the small pen is you can start putting smaller obstacles in there, like ground rails. You can put tires in there, things that they might be afraid of, but you just put them in there, but don't leave them in there. Don't make them live with it. But do the approach, the coax, approach, reward when they get there. And then you can apply the same techniques when you get into the enclosed area. First, they're going to balk from it, and you got to coax them into it. Then you got to lead them around the room. And if you got tack on the wall on the far side, they're going to wonder, what is all that junk? Why do you keep all that junk piled in this room? I can't see it all at once. There's too much of it. But again, you just walk as far as you can. When you feel that tension on the line, stop, cope, reward, and just do that all the way around the room if that's necessary. And the first time you do that, don't go any further. Just when you get around all complete rotation around the room, stop, reward, and say, you have been wonderful, and lead them back to their pen and turn them loose. And don't spend any more than 30, 40 minutes on this kind of stuff.
Okay.
If you drill on anything, they're going to get tired of it, and they're going to go, I know this game. I don't want to play anymore.
Right.
You don't want them to reach that point. But this little room here, then you go back and expand the time. They've already walked around the room, so the tension they're going to put on the line when you're just walking around the room and introducing them to the room again and again and again. First time, every time you enter that room, you walk around it. Because you might have put something new at the back of the room that they see that you forgot about. They see it, so let them see it. Just let them see it. Not a big deal. And if they know that you're going to let them see it, then they're less likely to bolt, drag you out of the building, and go run where they want. So this is a great place, and when you put a hitch rail into this area, make sure it's sunk in concrete and it's a strong hitch rail. I've got metal hitch rails in mine, and it's worth the expense to do it. You're going to be using it continuously. This is a major tool in your training. So don't cheat on expense or anything like that. It will pay for itself over time for sure. It's going to be a place where they're going to learn to be vacuumed. And the noise of the vacuum, if you have one, will be introduced. And I suggest you invest in one of those Equivacs because it's also very healthy for them to be vacuumed. It's a great way to get them super clean because a dandy brush, although it's very nice and you see a lot of dust coming off of them, there's a lot of dust that doesn't come off of them. Every time I'm going to saddle them, I use the vacuum cleaner. If I'm just doing a quick grooming, I don't use the vacuum cleaner because I don't want them to get sick of it. The noise alone is enough to kind of irritate me, so I figure it'll probably irritate them too.
Yeah.
Just don't overdo it. The clippers can make them very upset, and so sometimes you have to use the restraint that I use called face tie, and it's not like the quick twist because it just goes through the noseband around the hitch rail, and I'll let you go to my training tips on the website under training to look that up, and it explains all about how to convince the animal to get up to the hitch rail close enough so you can tie that noseband right to the hitch rail. But that's also why you need a very well-secured hitch rail, so that if they pull on it, they can't pull it up out of the ground or break it. And you might need it when you're going to first teach them to stand still for clipping their head or clipping their bridle path, because mules and donkeys will respect a hard tie. So you can tie their face to that hitch rail, and because they respect it, they'll hold still. And the most they might do when you're trying to use the clippers behind their ears and on their face and stuff is turn their head to the side to try to get away from you. But with a firmly secured hitch rail and their face tied right to the hitch rail like that, you have the luxury of either standing right next to them if they're a fairly calm animal. But if they're one that likes to fight back, you can go to the other side of the hitch rail and reach them from there, which puts you out of range from being striked or kicked from behind.
Right.
So, and there are two ways to tie that face tie. If you have to give shots or anything like that, there is a way to tie to that hitch rail where you take in the throat latch too, and you make them stand sideways to the hitch rail, and then you can approach them from either side, and they can't swing their hindquarters around enough to reach you. Like I said, you can look that up under my website at lucky3ranch.com under training tips. I explain that under restraints. These restraints are completely humane. Do not use these hard ties on a horse. They just won't go for it. I do exactly the opposite with the horses, and I keep them on a loose lead rope, and if I tie them up at all, I tie them with the end of the lead rope, so they've got like 6 feet of slack on that rope, and they are allowed to go back and away from me if they want to. Generally speaking, I don't like to tie even the end of the lead rope on the hitch rail, because if the horse feels any tension, horses are kind of stupid, and they feel that tension, and then they immediately want to go over backwards. So it's better not to tie them at all. But if you have a confined workstation, then it doesn't matter if they get loose or not. It doesn't matter if they're walking around the room and trying to avoid you. You can still follow them. And you can say, "Are you done yet?" and reach in the fanny pack and grab the oats and show them to them. If you're done, we can continue. And if they come over to you, then you give them the oats, and then you try to clip again or do whatever you're doing with the vacuum cleaner. It's the same thing. Cords on the equine vacuum cleaner are very long, so you can reach the animal from across the room if you have a small workstation area, like in a shed or something like that. You know, works quite well. A lot of people complain that the animals in their mutual grooming thing tend to eat each other's manes and tails, and so they do prefer roaching the manes on these mules, and that it's the way it's done. And I guess when you're driving mules and teams, and well, even if they're being driven single in work harness and stuff, the hair on the mule that grows out, it kind of grows like a fountain and goes straight up in the air and falls on both sides and kind of crazy and gets tangled up in the harness. But the other thing that happens is that during mutual grooming, they tend to munch on that hair and it gets chafed and falls out. So you got a mane that looks like somebody just chewed on them. I think that's the convenience of roaching the mane. But personally, I like beautiful manes on horses and mules, and some mules just don't have it. They've got stiff hair that insists on growing straight up, but I still...
Yeah.
They look kind of crazy, you know. But if he wants to look insane, well, okay. Okay, then. I will do my best. And what I do is I use Johnson's baby oil.
Yeah.
And I go in to groom once a week. And sometimes grooming is more extensive than other times. Sometimes you can get away with just a quick application in the summertime of the baby oil on the manes and tails. And the baby oil will train the hairs to lay down as much as you can on a wild mane. But the other thing that that does is it keeps them from doing mutual grooming on the manes and tails. They will tend to bite on the withers, on the neck, on the shoulder, on the butt, and other places if they're discouraged by the taste of the baby oil. Now, there are a lot of products out there that they say will discourage the chewing, but they don't work. This is the only thing that I have learned that really, really works well. In the springtime, you have a problem with mud and grooming. And if your mule is covered from head to tail with mud, he's trying to tell you that he has no intention nor no motivation to go riding, so leave him alone. When he's ready, he will roll on dry ground and start breaking that mud off his body. That's your signal that you're allowed to ride. You're allowed to groom and ride so that your saddle can go on a clean body. I learned this a long time ago when maybe CT, who never, ever liked getting dirty, decided she didn't want to go riding all the time. She was showing all the time, and she really wanted a rest a lot more often than I realized. And so she started covering herself from head to tail with mud. And then she would smile at me.
Whoa.
So I went, well, if you're that adamant about it, we don't need to ride today. And then I just turned her out, and she was fine. And then I came back the next day, and she had rolled. And in the grass, they have a much better way of getting that mud off. That grass will just wear on it until the mud falls off. And then you don't have as much mud to get off. But you may still have mud to remove, especially in the spring. You know, they can't get it all. Then you're kind of forced to use a shedding blade. Now, when you use those metal shedding blades with the teeth on one side and smooth on the other, what I do with those is I will use the smooth side, generally speaking. When I give them a bath in July, their yearly bath, and that's just to shed the water off as I'm hosing them down. And I don't use any soap or anything anywhere but on the mane and tail, and I use Tresemme and the 3X conditioner on the manes and tails just to keep the moisture in their manes and tails. And to keep the moisture in the hair coat, I just use water, just plain water over their bodies. I didn't even have to use soap when I was showing them, because the proper feeding and weekly grooming will keep their hair coat shiny and healthy all by itself.
Right.
And I found that those products that they give you for a shiny coat only add stuff to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I wash my own hair, I don't like using gels. I don't like using anything that doesn't wash out. It just makes it kind of dull, kind of dry, and promotes split ends and that kind of stuff that keeps the hair coat from looking really healthy. When you're using this shedding blade, keeping in mind that you want a healthy hair coat, you need to know how to use those teeth on the shedding blade very carefully on that mud. The mud that's left over, if there's a lot of mud, like I said, don't even go there. Go ahead and wait a day for most of it to be rubbed off by them, because they will do it in grass, and that doesn't compromise the hair. This is Mother Nature. This is what Mother Nature does to groom your mules, and they know how to do that. You know, you can leave that to them. But if you have to artificially groom them, then do it with some finesse. Go to a little patch of mud, and like you would do with the hair, with a brush on their manes and tails, and I use human hair brushes, plastic human hair brushes with a lot of bristles on them, not the ones with really sparse bristles, but with a lot of plastic bristles on them with little balls on the end, you start at the bottom of the hair and work your way up. You do the same thing on the mud patches. You start at the bottom and you work your way up with the shedding blade, because if you work at the top, what it's going to do is it's going to pull on the hair underneath, and it's going to aggravate your animal because it's pulling too much too fast. If you start on the bottom, you can start at the bottom of the mud patch and just take a little area that's maybe like an eighth of an inch wide, get that off, then go up again and again and again until you reach the top. And that way, you're pulling the hair underneath from the bottom of the hair. Make sense?
All right. Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah, it's just one of those silly details that my mules taught me by moving away from me and swinging over and trying to kick me when I try to start at the top.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, they have ways of telling you. You need to be more polite with the grooming tools.
Yeah.
And the same thing when you're given a bath, for instance, be careful not to get water in their eyes or their ears.
Mm-hmm.
I always put my hand over the ears and flatten them to the neck and take the sprayer on the hose. And I start up at the forehead, so I'm going down the head, so when the water comes onto their face, it rolls off their eyes and not into their eyes. Same thing with the nostrils, and just move my way down that way, and then when I'm doing the ears, I have my hand over the ears, and I just flatten them against the neck, and then just shoot the sprayer right across the ears, and just keep my hand right at the base to keep the ear closed and where it is, but I can still put the spray over the ear, and it'll wash the dirt right from the bottom off the tip of the ear and down the neck. I do the whole animal that way. I start in the front, move my way to the back. I also, in my workstation, because sometimes I have to use the hoses if they get too much mud up their legs or extremely muddy tails and manes, and it may be kind of cool outside. I don't want to take them outside and use a hose. I would rather have a hose inside where it's just a hair warmer, then I can use it in there. So I want to make sure that there's a spigot where I can attach a hose, and if it's just a shed that doesn't have water to it, you can still put a hydrant right outside the shed and have a hose long enough that can reach inside. There are different ways you can set up your workstation so it doesn't have to be as fancy as the one I've. I took years before I actually built the workstation the way I wanted, and until then, I worked out of an old rusty Quonset hut and just had rubber mats on the floor, and we just sunk holes for the posts for the hitch rails into the concrete, and I put up with that for years before I had enough money to alter that and make it better. The other thing, too, is when you're introducing to tacking equipment, you should make a regular job of that, too, right from the beginning, just like the halter. Get them introduced to it. Even if they're young, you can still introduce them to the saddle. You can introduce them to the bridle, but you're not going to do anything with it but put it on and take it off. And you do that so that you can make sure that your tack and equipment fit the animal that you're going to put it on. And when they're younger, one, two, three, they're going to be growing. So every time you try that stuff on, you're going to get a different fit. And so you adjust your tack and equipment, and that's the job of the imprinting of the tack and equipment in the small area where you're not actually going to use it. You're just going to put it on, and you're going to take it off. You'll put it on, you're going to adjust it, you're going to take it off. And if they spook at it while you're doing it, you're going to do something very definite. If you're holding a small saddle or holding the bridle or whatever and they move, when you try to take it on or off, you take a step back, which is what you were doing before, and you wait for them to stand still. And then you go, oh, you want some of this? Now that you're standing still, I'll give it to you. And you walk over there, but you're still hanging on to the bridle. You're still got the saddle. Hopefully it's a lightweight saddle that you can hold in one arm, you know. Use the other one to reach in your fanny pack and feed them the oats and show them the saddle. And you want to make sure that everything is okay before you try to slide that saddle on their back or put that bridle over their head. Just show them what it is. Jiggle the bit around. It should be a snaffle. It should make a lot of noise. And that's probably a really good thing that it does. But you want them to stand still when you're working on them. People ask me, too, well, what if my mule is pawing? What if he's... won't stand still and he moves around and everything. I guarantee you that if you set the standard of I'm only going to ask you to stand still when I'm working on you, then it doesn't matter what he's doing when you're not. You're going to get the saddle and he starts pawing and he starts moving around and everything. When you get back with the saddle, all he needs to do is stand still when you approach him. So you teach him to stand still first before you even start picking up tack and equipment. When you're grooming, he needs to stand still while you're doing it. And anytime he starts moving around or shoving you out of the way or doing any of these unacceptable behaviors, take a step back, reach in your fanny pack, look at him and go, don't you want this? Right?
You bet.
And granted, he will know what that means, with or without the talking equipment. And you're building habits here, very important behaviors. He will learn that when you're stepping back, that means you don't want to come to him. You don't want to interact with him because he's not standing still. And this all takes place in the workstation for a reason. And standing still and being docile and calm and no anxiety and everything are behaviors that need to become normal behaviors. And they can only become normal behaviors when you're consistent and repetitive over a long period of time. Now, one of the things, once you've got your guy all used to the tack and equipment, you can figure it's been probably a whole year, because after you've gotten him used to the small pen, and then you get him used to the small work area, then it's time to take him into the hourglass pattern and begin his core strength work. And this is going to take place in your arena. And there are things about the hourglass pattern under training tips on the website as well. And it'll show you how to do it and everything. But you're going to graduate him from the workstation to the hourglass pattern. And you're going to get him used to our postural aid, the elbow pull, in the workstation before you even take him out to the hourglass pattern. He needs to know that elbow pull is not that restrictive. So you have his lead rope over his bridle, and you put that elbow pull on, and you adjust it. And you adjust it so that his head can go as high as he wants to put it above the withers before he inverts at the pole and hollows his neck. That's how you tell about the adjustment of this elbow pull. You want to make sure that when you're trying to adjust it, that he's not working against you. So you start out by rocking his nose and making him just give at the pole, rock it forward and up and down and up and down and up and down until you feel he's really relaxed. Then you can go ahead and take the offside end of the elbow pull and take it over the pole, down through the bit rings, between the front legs and up to the offside and secure it. Then you go to the near side and you rock his nose till the pole is comfortable and relaxed. And then you see how high his head is at that point, but you don't automatically tie off that side. You'll go down through the bit rings again from that side and through the front legs and up to where you want to secure it on the saddle or the surcingle. But again, you're going to rock his nose again, and you're going to encourage him to just kind of give it the pull. Then you'll have the elbow pull in your right hand, and you put your left hand underneath his muzzle and push his head up. And you push that head up to the point where he's just about ready to invert his head, because that will be the highest point he can raise it. And it will be substantially above his withers. And that's where you attach the tension. You're just stopping him from being able to raise his head so high that he can invert his neck. Because if he's inverting his neck, he's going to invert his back. Right. And he will be out of good posture. And so you've already got the halter on because he's tied up to the hitch rail, ready to go. And you will take him to the open area where you have your four cones in the four corners of the arena. And you'll start your leading exercises there. And the information about the hourglass pattern and how to negotiate it, again, is under training tips on my website. And you'll do all the exercises in that hourglass pattern, and that will take you roughly about 3 to 6 months, depending on how old he is, how experienced he is, how he is naturally conformed and carries himself. The ones that have very poor conformation and a very bad way of moving, and we usually call these animals rough gaited, will take the time to build that core muscles at the base of the skeleton. And it's not just the muscles, it's the tendons, the ligaments, the connective tissues, the cartilage, in order to get even wear in the cartilage and the joints. This is why we have to address core muscle strength, a postural core muscle strength, by the way, in good balance, so that the animal will learn to move correctly, so all the bones in his body can move correctly, and they'll be substantially supported by all these different elements. And this is not bulk muscle. And they have to do this on the flat in the hourglass pattern first before you add coordination with your obstacles. And again, I've got the obstacles are covered, how to do them, how to approach with the cope and reward system so that they are moving correctly and they will be in their elbow pull. And we start these exercises at the end of the hourglass pattern exercises, which they should be doing very easily, so they won't take quite as long, but you introduce them and the obstacles fall within the 3 to 6 months. And it may be they learn the hourglass pattern on the flat ground in 3 months, but when you introduce the obstacles, that might be another 3 months. Essentially, to build this core will take you roughly 9 months to a year to complete. And you should be ready with that. Again, I say you're going to learn patience. If you want to do this right, you're going to learn patience, and your animal will appreciate it because he's going to feel better. And you're not going to have any resistance to the things that you're asking him to do because you're preparing him for every step with the steps before. And they're not big steps. They're little steps. So if there's a gap, if there's a big gap and you're getting resistance, back up. Back up in your training, go back to the steps before and repeat them, because that just means it didn't take. It didn't take at the level of the skeleton. And you can't see that, so you can't really tell unless they tell you. And they will tell you with anxiety or with resistance. It's really important to do all of this and to get all of your balance and a substantial core and the coordination that comes with the obstacles before you take them to the round pen. Now, people have been talking about how dangerous it is to train in a round pen. Well, the danger lies in the fact that the animal is taken in there for the first part of training without a substantial core to support all the exercises that you're doing in the round pen. And yeah, if they're running around the round pen and they're leaning like a motorcycle, they're putting a tremendous amount of stress on the inside legs, and they're even on the outside legs. They're stretching the outside legs too much on the outside, and they're putting too much downward pressure on the inside leg and compressing all of the things in the knees, the fetlocks, the hooves, everything. And it can make for the hooves eventually on a soft foot might be growing radically the wrong way. The other thing that I have learned too from doing rock and roll, and I had to start them in the hourglass pattern too before we moved to the round pen, but they had hooves that were erratically trimmed, and so I saw a lot of collapse in the feet, and the condition of the hooves was very poor. And just the oats mix that I recommend with the Show Glow vitamins and the Mazola corn oil was not enough. They were 17, 18 years old, and so we opted to take on a supplement called Hoof Power. And at first, we tried other products that were not as good. So now that my animals are all pretty much over 25 years old, we put Hoof Power in the oats mix all the time now. And the amounts are on the bags that you can get. We get the growth, you know, the big bags. I'm sure they offer it in smaller quantities. But that product has been phenomenal. Even my animals that have light-colored feet have good, hard hooves with no stress rings in them or anything. And I keep them barefoot unless I'm using them extensively, so the hooves aren't chipping or cracking or anything like that. And that's also what's really important, is to have your small pens and your turnout off the stalls or the runs 4 inches done in pea gravel and not anything else. Sand, they can sand colic on that. But the pea gravel is round, and it doesn't chip feet like structural fill or anything with big rocks in it. So that's a good way. But the area, you can't just leave it in dirt, because that surface isn't hard enough to keep the hardness of the feet. The feet, in order to stay hard, need to be stressed, as do bones. And in order for them to get hard, you need a good hard surface to work on. And the pea gravel is hard enough. It's hard enough to keep the bones good because they're not sinking. It promotes good drainage. Is soft enough for them, when you put 4 inches in there, it's soft enough for them to lay down without causing pressure sores. And then you're not faced with mud, which will do nothing but soften and compromise the condition of the feet. So every little thing that you do is super important. And then when you move to the round pen, if you've done this year's prep work on the postural core around the skeleton, then when you get to the round pen, you'll probably put them in there, and you've been leading them right next to their shoulder and doing the halts and everything, and they've learned all of this communication language with you, both verbal and body language. But they're not going to know what to do when you take the lead rope off and put them on a rail. So what they're going to do is they're going to run around the round pen. But the difference between doing all this basic postural core strength training first and if you don't do it is that at least when you've done it, they're going to run that circle in the round pen in good posture. And they'll probably start at the trot. The other thing is that you want the size of that round pen to be beneficial to your training program, but not so small that it's going to compromise what you've built in the core strength training. So it needs to be big enough to allow them to be in good posture, because doing smaller circles takes a lot more stress on the animal's body to hold them erect and bend through the torso and keep equal weight over all 4 feet. The other thing that you need to consider is that it's not so big that you can't reach them with your lunge whip. So I have found that the ideal sized round pen is 45 feet in diameter. The other thing that you want to think about is the natural terrain that you're on needs to be flat. And I didn't realize how important that really was until I was having problems with lunging multiple animals, and some had trouble and some didn't, maintaining their postural strength. I didn't realize what a problem there would be when I thought that my round pen, looking at it visually, looked like it was on flat ground. But I saw that when I was lunging multiple animals, that some had problems and some didn't. And that's when I saw that my round pen was actually going downhill. And I could see it also because when it snowed, as the snow began to melt, it would be dry on the high side and puddle up on the low side. Although not by much, but it wasn't flat. So we tore it down, we shot it with a transit, and rebuilt it. And since then, haven't had any problems with the animals traveling in good posture. It's really important if you've worked for a whole year to get that good posture, and then you put them in a round pen that's not on flat ground, it's going to undo everything. And they're not going to be ready for you to ride if you've undone all the core strength training. Make sense?
Sure does.
So the other thing you might want to take a look at, too, under mule crossing is the way we rebuilt this round pen. We rebuilt this round pen so that it has easily removable boards. It has spaces between the boards, so if your animal gets aggressive and you have to jump the fence, you can get a toe in and jump the fence. It is lined with angle iron so they can't chew on the boards. I have a, I guess you could call me anal. Go after these details because I don't like doing things over and over and over again, you know. And then we go ahead and bed the round pen with a 3 to 4 inch base of soft dirt or sand. When you're first beginning with these animals that are not conditioned very well, it's probably better to go with 3 inches. And then later, as they become more conditioned and you want to make things a little bit more of an exercise, then you can add another inch to make them work harder, if that makes sense.
Sure.
When you're working in the round pen, be sure to watch your own body language and see how that affects your animal, because there's a lot of things you can learn in there, too. And that is covered with all the training things that I have outlined for you in some of these other interviews and in the tapes and the books. And look for equal weight over all 4 feet in all 3 gates, executed through the reverses and the halts correctly. Just make sure every move he does is perfect. Don't ever let him go in an unrestricted frame. Make sure he's got that elbow pull on all the time. And the reason it's so important, because this is your indication on whether or not he is putting things equal weight over all 4 feet. Is he arcing his body from head to tail? Is he traveling smoothly? Are his back legs going into his front feet prints? And the way you can tell is if there's tension between his nose and his chest with the elbow pull. If he's out of balance and he's having difficulty, he's going to lean on that elbow pull, raise his head, and it will be tight between his nose and his chest. And when he's in good posture, it's going to be loose. Mm-hmm. So you can actually watch your animal in a round pen as he's going and see whether he is maintaining that good posture or not. And when he is consistently showing good posture in the round pen, only then is he ready to go out into the open and be ridden. And when he is ridden in the open arena, you leave that elbow pull on and you go ahead and use it. And always, you will always start with even ground driving in the round pen first, in the elbow pull first, and teach him all the rein cues and directional cues in the ground driving. You will get your own rhythm, cadence, and walking straight and all of that in the round pen before you go into the open arena. So he's learning everything. He learned in the hourglass pattern in the arena being led, you were following his front feet. So you were matching his rhythm and cadence there. And when he finally finished those exercises, he followed you through obstacles with regular rhythm and cadence. When you ground drove him in the round pen, then you were following his back leg with rhythm and cadence. So when you mounted him in the round pen, you've already taught your own body to follow his body. You're halfway there, more than halfway. And when you got on him in the round pen and started riding him, then you made sure that all your cues and everything were done in a balanced fashion, posturally, and you worked on your own good posture while riding. You were always working on your own good posture while you were leading, while you were ground driving. So that when you get on him in the round pen, the only thing he needs to learn how to get used to is moving away from the pressure on your legs. And so when you get into the open arena and start riding him in the open arena, you will ride him through the hourglass pattern again. It's familiar. It's non-threatening. There's not a road to anxiety and resistance because he's going to know what this means. The only difference is you're on top of him. You will also, when you are teaching the ground driving in the round pen, after he's very proficient with going around the round pen and then reversing and doing S-turns through the middle and everything, he's gotten used to the reins and what they mean and what those cues are in the reins. And so you will ground drive him in this hourglass pattern in the open arena before you ride him in the open arena. So when he gets in the open arena, he already knows all your aids.
Yeah.
He knows the hourglass pattern. He knows the halt in the hourglass pattern. He knows the rein cues. He knows your leg cues that you presented to him in the round pen. Everything has happened up to the round pen. So when you get into the open, there's not going to be hardly any resistance at all. He's going to get out there and he goes, oh, I know what this is. So this is review for him. And this is reinforcement for all the things that you taught him and all the body language and all the verbal commands and talk and communication that you have done together up to this point. So now when you get into the open arena, you're just reinforcing what you've already taught him. And in the round pen, that was the only place that he was able to really get to walk, trot, canter. But when you get to this under saddle, now you can get him comfortable at the walk, reinforce what the aids mean, and then you can even drop your reins, put a neck strap on him, and ride him without using the rein cues. Ride him from your seat bones and your legs. Teach him what that's all about. And you can do all this stuff in the hourglass pattern in the open arena at the walk. And once he's really good at the walk, then you pick up your reins again and you do it at the trot. And then you can, when he's really proficient at that, then put your neck strap on again, then go ahead and do it at the trot. And you realize that in this hourglass pattern, there are four places to halt. You can add a backup at the halt and then go forward again. You can do it with the reins, without the reins. And then when he's really proficient that way, then you can go ahead and you can alter the pattern again by adding canter. So you can go through the pattern in the middle and then pick up the canter along the short side and then slow it down around the cones, bring it back into the middle, going to the gate cones, go through that the same way as the trot. Then when you come around the next short side, pick up the canter again and alternate that. Then you can go from that pattern to not going to the hourglass pattern and move on to where we were fine-tuning the aids, which we talked about last time. And so you modify the pattern to only include the short sides of the arena and the long sides, and you can go ahead and go through the short side at the trot, at a collected trot, and you can go to a lengthened trot on the long sides. Then as it's modified even further, once he gets to really listening to your aids and everything, then you can go ahead and add the canter. You can canter in collection. You can start out by collecting the trot in the short side, moving to a canter, a lengthened canter down the long side, shorten it up, collected trot down the short side. Then you can stay in canter and lengthen the canter on the long sides, collect the canter on the short sides. So this is where your training program becomes even more meticulous and more effective, using the postural strength that you put in on your animal, and it gets you to a rather advanced foundation to where you can do just about anything you want in these environments that we're talking about, and doing the whole workout in the environment in a natural course, which one thing builds on the other, but you're always doing the same approaches, the same way in each of these areas, all the way from the confined small pen with an animal that's schizo to the workstation, to the open hourglass pattern in the open confined arena, to the round pen, and then back to the open arena again, both in on the lead rope, in the drive lines, and then eventually with you under saddle. And that's why it's so important to have designated work areas and use them in a designated, consistent, and repetitive way every single time you train. Because the more easily the animal can recognize what's coming next, the more you lower the incidence of anxiety and resistance. It helps you both stay focused, and I might say at this point too, an arena without cones is like a house without furniture.
Well, you're right about that. Yeah.
Right. Well, would you know what to do in an empty room? Or would you start looking around and getting all anxious?
Yeah, there you go. This has been very educational. And Meredith, I can't wait for us to talk again. So you have a really good rest of your day, and we will talk soon.
Sounds great, Cindy.
Meredith's website is lucky3ranch.com, and you can call her at 1-800-816-7566. And I can be reached through my website, everycowgirlsdream.com.
Gotta go. My mule is looking for me.
Mule Talk is an Every Cowgirl's Dream production.